This is an interview by Christopher Garofalo, G-A-R-O-F-A-L-O, with Dr. John Goldsberry, currently at his house/office, which is at 122 Forest Street. Today is October 12th, 1995, and it is now 1:30 in the afternoon.
Okay.
Is there, I guess, anything in particular that you wanted to talk about? Or I know they had approached you and you said that you, you know, wanted to, you know, you were willing to do this. So, you know, I've done a couple. I've asked if, you know, based on anything you want to talk about. Otherwise, I can, you know, start things off.
I'll let you take it.
Okay. I guess we can just start by getting a background history on you. You know, I know you had said earlier that you were, you know, born in Worcester and you've lived here for most of your life. But you can just kind of give us a little capsule of, you know, where you went to school and medical school and how that was for you. I'd especially like to get your perspective on what medical school was like for you.
Well, let me see. So I went to undergraduate school at Howard University in Washington, D.C. Started in 48.
Mm-hmm.
Was drafted at the Korean War. As a policeman for Truman, that's police action. Stayed there for a couple of years and returned to undergraduate school. Finished in, good Lord, what year? 55, I believe. Then I went to graduate school for a year and then started medical school. No, I think I started medical school in 55, that's it, yeah.
Okay.
Let's see.
Where was that at?
That was at the same school, Howard University. I was in an automobile accident halfway through my sophomore year.
Oh, no.
Yes. I remained in traction for a fractured lumbar spine for the remainder of the sophomore year, so I had to then return the following, second semester, because medical school doesn't clock regular, and you know, there's no catching up.
Oh, no.
During the year in which I was out, I spent as a chemist working for the NIH, which was enjoyable, and worked with some rather important people. Then having the unique distinction after that tenure at NIH of being able to work in NIH during my vacation times. I was working for the National Institutes of Metabolic Diseases.
What kind of work were you doing?
As a chemist, research chemist. Working with various acids that they were trying to isolate. And so my job was to obtain this acid called sialic acid from urine.
Oh, never heard of that before.
Yes. So we did put these huge cowboys, 20 liter, 20 gallon, whatever, cowboys in the men's room and with funnels. And once a week we would put these on cation exchange, an anion exchange, running through these huge columns of cation and anion exchanges. Finally, somewhere down the line, we were cracking this stuff. But that was interesting. However, let's get back to medical school. I guess that's what you're going to want to know. Well, Howard is, at that time, was predominantly, it still is predominantly black medical school, located in Washington, D.C. It is funded by the government for the most part under the land grant schools, which also funds the Gallaudet College for the Deaf there in D.C. Medical school at that time was required to have a certain percent, I think 10% of the population was non-black, and another 10% were females. So it was rather unique in that it did turn out at least 8 to 9 females MDs every year. Currently it's 53% female.
Really?
Yeah. And and it's, I don't know what percent of the school population now is non-minority, but I haven't been there for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
The medical curriculum at that time was basically designed for primary care. I guess that's what we call it now.
Okay.
But at those days, we call it, what they call it?
General
practice.
Thanks.
So it was years for that. The philosophy at that time was because we were minorities, in order to get half as far, we should probably know twice as much. So they proceeded with that. I don't know what the situation is now. I remember the first year that, 55, yeah, we had 83 one-hour examinations.
Yeah, oh my.
40-hour week school. 40 what?
Well,
whatever it was. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it was awful. But,
two exams a week?
Yeah, we just went from exam to exam.
Oh. My.
So, naturally, most of the time, there weren't really any of it. But most of us survived. Our dropout rate was probably 3 or 4 in the course of the 4 years. And a few victims like myself graduated a year later. They were starting, I guess is what they were trying to do, the integrated courses.
Okay.
And medicine and surgery and physiology and pathology and all of these things they were trying to integrate into one big mess, I guess I should call it. It was early in the stage. It was really preparing for the American boards, which were in the infancy. For which most of us took. However, few of us relied upon the national boards, because the landmark states of the Maryland board. At that time, they had reciprocity with many more states national boards, yeah. Let's see, the first 2 years were pre-clinical years, were the usual courses, I guess.
Did you have any patient contact during those first 2 years? They seem to be getting more towards patient contact.
Uh-huh. They were starting patient contact, but it was very, very minimal, because no one knew what to do.
Right.
Yeah. They were trying to follow a core curriculum, but the accreditors were, I don't know, they were in the infancy trying to develop this, and everything was in a state of flux. But usual, I guess, courses like such as anatomy, neural anatomy, biochemistry, yellow level physical. Do they still have that? You don't have your little shot?
No.
Oh, goodness.
No, that I haven't heard of.
Oh, you haven't heard of. Okay.
No, we now have.
That was an offshoot of the MD Meyerhoff pathway.
Oh.
Yeah, they still have that? Then it goes down to the Krebs cycle. You had to memorize that.
I think we started with the Krebs cycle.
Oh, we started up and went down.
Okay.
Anatomy, I guess, is the same.
Yep.
We did all have our individual, not individual, the twos per body in anatomy. We did the body from the neck down because of the dental school in the face and neck. And we, now that was always covered up, so we never did see the face, because when the dental students finished, they would cover it up again, so it would bother me. So from the neck down, we were pretty good as anatomists. We had the notorious bone walks. Do they still have those?
No, what are those?
Bone walk? They would put bones out and point to various things. What is this? What does this
do? Oh.
Yeah, you had to be aware, you know. They wouldn't ask you what the name of the bone was.
Oh, okay.
What is inserted here? Where did this go?
Oh, right, yeah.
Those were all terrible attacks. But that was the professor's favorite trick.
How was third and fourth year?
Third and fourth year were clinical years. And then we had what they call clinical clerkships.
Mm-hmm.
In the various subtopics, gynecology, obstetrics, general surgery, orthopedics, neurology, the full thing. So we covered that fairly well. The probably the toughest. Problem was transportation.
How's that?
Well, most of these students didn't have access to automobiles like they have now.
True.
And our faculty would have to take the subway, they didn't have subway, we call it the public transportation to and from various hospitals all over the city. That did.
That must have done a number.
Yeah, that did, right. And nowadays we got pocket lots and all that, and everybody got cars, so it's no problem. Yeah. I didn't own a car until I was.
Oh, really? Wow.
Now I'm married, man.
Oh, really?
When did you get married?
I got married my junior year.
Junior year.
Uh-huh.
How did you find that, being married in medical school?
Well, actually, it was a godsend to me. Because it did cause me to settle down and take notice.
Mm.
I married, let me see. No, I got married my sophomore year. I married a senior at the time.
Oh.
No, the day we got married, it was the day after she graduated.
Oh, really?
So I married a doctor. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Great.
And there was no help because she was an intern.
Right. There you go. Yeah.
So I couldn't really get any further information from her, but we managed to get through. Then we had a son born, I guess, let's see, at the end of my, in my junior year. And I had a daughter born in my senior year, so.
Oh, very good.
Just before coming to Worcester, I had two children. Yes, see, how old are you?
24.
24, okay, my baby is 6 years older than you. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And then you said you returned to Worcester for your postgraduate?
For my, graduate, my, we call it internship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Those days we were called interns and the residents.
Okay.
Now we call postgraduates 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever you have. That was the big year, I guess, in 60, that they decided that interns were in fact students and couldn't strike. But those days, I guess, as all people that might remember, you were on every other day, every other weekend. I mean, every other day, every other night, every other weekend. The weekend started Friday morning and Sunday. Monday afternoon. There was before anything was known as students being overworked, overtaxed,
right,
making mistakes. I guess we made mistakes. I don't know. I probably made a mistake. But we did have what was called JARs,
Junior Assistant Resident.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so they were JARs.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had the intermediate resident and the senior resident. So we would work with the JARs for the most part. Basically, very little real clinical work was done by interns in those days, other than writing history and physical making a stab at a diagnosis. And then the rest of the work day was strictly starting fluids and occasionally you would go on mouth with the ligament.
Okay.
Yeah. But your job basically was that of taking care of the the work no one else wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's got work.
It's got work. Yeah, I guess they still do that.
I think so the first year, yeah.
Right. And occasionally you give them a pearl of wisdom. So we I had a general rotating internship. Most of the people at that time did general rotatings. Very few had street surgical, street medicine. Probably was unheard of. Most of us really didn't know what we really wanted to do. Probably, I didn't really make up my mind until my junior year in undergraduate school that I wanted to go to medical school.
Oh.
I was a botany major.
Mm-hmm.
And,
really?
Then I decided that, hey, I'll never make a living in botany. Switch over to medicine.
How much did your father play a role in that? Now, your father was a doctor in Massachusetts, in Worcester as well, and he was the first African American to...
No,
I can't remember now.
No, he was not. There were, when I was a child, there were three African American physicians in the city of Worcester.
He was the first one to get privileges or something in a hospital?
He was,
like that?
No. He had privileges.
Yep,
that's okay. At the Alamo Hospital.
Okay.
Originally, we always call that the hospital on the hill. He was turned down from Memorial Hospital. Matter of fact, he was appointed to St. Vincent's in the early years, I would say somewhere in the young 50s. He was appointed there through, basically because of the bishop.
Oh, really?
He had a new bishop. When they just started the bishopship, I guess the bishop thought that it would be wise for the church to, I mean for the hospital to have him on the staff there, which he did have a postgraduate work at Harvard Public Health.
Oh,
and so he had a master's degree in public health, and he was a very learned man. He had done course at Beth Israel at Boston for years, and I guess, let me see, he became boarded, I guess, in internal medicine or something. In 53, actually, and he came on the staff at City Hospital when I was accepted as a intern.
Oh.
So his life and the life of most of the minority physicians in Worcester was not that pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And with a master's degree and being on the assistant to the Commissioner of Health in Worcester.
Wow.
He could never make it to the Commissioner.
Jeez. How do you feel that that has changed, the minority status in Worcester, I guess, and also, you know, you're familiar in general in the country, let's say, getting into medical school and then once you're out of medical school?
Okay, let's take Harvard University in 1950, I guess, 54, all of Boston medical school, three, I think we only had about, at the most, eight or nine students, and we're talking in 12 collective years.
Wow, so less than one a year.
Less than one a year.
Among the three schools?
Among the three schools.
less than one every 3 years for each school, then.
Right.
Wow.
And, Howard and Harry turned out 99% of all the minority black physicians in the country. Now the situation is different. I really don't know what the percentages are now. I haven't been keeping track. Yeah, there is. Well, I guess they probably could be classified as my paranoia. Still areas of, I'll say, uncomfortableness upon my part. today. How's that? I recently was dealing with a physician who was overtly conscious of the fact that I was black, oftentimes in his subtle remarks.
That must have been very uncomfortable.
Which tends to be uncomfortable, as he was one of my chiefs. But we've learned through the years how to live it with these, and most part, we don't show any animosity at the time, but we are, and it does give you a little unnecessary heartburn.
Sure, of course.
And but when it's one of your teeth, what can you do? Mm-hmm. You're just smiling, going about your business.
Do you find that to be much decreased now?
It is decreased considerably. It is probably less obvious.
Okay.
Much more subtle. I don't know. Maybe my wife is has the same problem, but I guess this is something we really don't sit down and talk about. It's just something you just feel.
Sure.
You know that through your own paranoia, which you develop through the fact that you've lived here all of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess everyone has a degree of paranoia. Actually, this particular guy I have in mind is an American citizen that had went to a foreign medical school, so maybe he's got his problems too.
Yeah.
And he can't express them any other way than properly expressing them. But that's
you expect him to be much more
sympathetic.
Yeah.
Right.
Hmm.
But them's the breaks. But I have not had the luxury of having a lot of consultations from various physicians. And so because of that, I've become always worked as a chief of the service. Would deal with patients by way of my therapist.
Right.
And would make suggestions by way of the therapist what should be done, so I was able to get my points across with the therapist. The fact that these patients were referred to the physical therapy department, and I happen to be there.
Right.
But very few real actual consults. I worked at Rutland for 25 years. I was ran the rehabilitation department there.
Mm-hmm. Was this in addition to the practice that you had out of your house here?
Right. Most of my practice out of the house was, 80% was primary care, for the simple reason when my father died. He left about 50 or 60 patients that refused to go elsewhere.
Really?
Yeah. And literally, during the past 15, 16 years, they have finally succumbed. And so I said, now I can really, don't have to practice. I was unique, and then for a little bit, I was able to do some primary care through Central Mass. Those patients I have given up, so you can't be a primary practice and a specialist at the same time. These new rules and regulations have come down through the years. And
not too bad.
Yes, I don't. I guess we're infringing on somebody else's income.
How did you like doing what you were doing? And you were in physical therapy.
Physical medicine. Yeah, rehabilitation.
So rehab,
yeah.
Okay. And how did you, how did you like that? And how do you feel that field has changed since you entered it?
Well, for many years,
I was the only one in the city of Worcester.
There was a large need at that time?
Yes, it was developing. And what we really needed was someone of academic background. Me, I have absolutely no interest in academia or what it resembles.
Mm-hmm.
I felt as though I wanted to be with the patients rather than talk about them. We've had, through the years, about five people come in and stay a while and leave because most of them seem to be hostile toward physical medicine rehabilitation.
Hmm.
It was highly orthopedic orientated town.
Yeah, you were able to establish a practice there.
Right, but I guess I just stuck you to it. You know, this is my home, and damn it, I'm not moving. I got four kids, and I'm not going to...
Good for you.
Yeah. So come hell or high water, I'm staying. I eat out a fairly good living, I guess. I'm not what they call a BMW type guy.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a comfortable home. I can sit back and retire, not lack of luxury, but I'll be able to live. I just found out after I had retired from Fairmont a couple of weeks ago, actually. We now have 1, 2, 3, I think 5 physiatrists at Fairmont Rehabilitation Center. There is another one in town in active practice. I don't know how she's doing. I plan to give her a call in a few days to see if she could do some pick up some work for me. So this is what's going on in physical medicine now. Of the 5, they're all good Lord. Younger men,
mm-hmm.
I would say less than 38.
Wow.
I said I have a 37-year-old son.
Mm-hmm. No.
So it is sort of difficult.
Are any of your children doctors?
No.
No? Okay.
No. Let me see. I got one that's working on a PhD in public health policy.
Oh.
One is an electrical engineer working for Quantum.
Oh.
Yeah, one was a environmental engineer working for EPA.
Oh, very good.
And my oldest son, what is he? I don't know what he does. He's a computer analyst. I have no idea. He just travels all over the country.
Right.
They were all, would say, mathematically inclined.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe probably delve into that area which they could handle the best.
Yeah.
Yeah. What else? Medicine has changed. I could say at one time medicine was a lot of fun. You do what you want to do when you want to do it and how you want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And you could spend as much time as you wanted with the patient. And I say keep it within scope. Now, with these HMOs and these doctors working for HMOs, good Lord, they don't have time to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
They are on a production line schedule. Like, that's my impression. They're as busy as they stay. The days of old when you gamble out in the morning and go on rounds in the hospital and eat lunch and then go to your office in the afternoon and probably work till 6.
Mm.
Well, they're over. Now it's, you know, I guess it's 8 to 6. Then they have everyone, you know, being cared for in the hospital by the hospital team. I don't know. They're
Let's see. Everybody is under a plan. If you're not under a plan, you got to find some doctor that's under the plan that you're under. They talk about, you know, being able to keep the doctor of your choice if you don't join every plan.
Right.
As an MD, and most MDs can't, so they have to be in a group. And the group takes care of everybody being in various plans. A solo practitioner can't do it.
You don't think so?
No. Just filling out the applications alone.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel that has impacted on patients and their care?
I have probably they're getting better care. Maybe not. Every patient has a different need.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some patients need these experts that are telling you do this, you do that, and others need to sit down and talk to them. I don't know. I lost patients that, you know, go to work, and the work has changed plans on them, and they say, well, look, doctor, I got to go to who do I go to?
That must be tough.
It is.
For them as well as for
right.
you.
Yes. I mean, somebody you've been working with for a few years, and just because the company decided to change from this plan to that plan because they don't have to pay so much money
right.
for this plan. I guess this is going to the new way. And how long it'll last, I don't know. I think it's going to last as long as people get up and, you know, start jumping up and down and say, hell no, we won't go.
Right.
My daughter was in my granddaughter, 14-month-old, was at Children's Hospital about 2 months ago because of spinal meningitis, viral variety, and she's absolutely well now. But after 3 days of Children's, they said, well, we'll move her back to Lowell Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter jumped up and down and screamed and said, well, what are you doing that for? That's blah, 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 blah. And then she gave them a few incidents where they themselves weren't on the button
mm-hmm.
as far as getting money for medicine, you know, and she needed all that. And they backed off, and she was able to stay there 3 or 4 more days.
Mm.
But it's things like that, I think that's going to probably bring everything under some form of control.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the doctors jumping up and down
right.
in the morning. It has to be the recipients.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's going to really make the difference, in my opinion. They can arouse them to that fact that, look, you're the one that's going to make these determinations.
Right.
I can't do anything. I can scream and yell at them, but get enough of people.
Hmm.
Maybe something will happen. They complain about governmental medicine. I mean, what was Blue Cross Blue Shield?
Right.
Other than socialized governmental type medicine, what was the Kaiser? Or not Kaiser, what was the miners? United Miners, when they had their 7 hospitals down there in West Virginia, Pennsylvania. That was a form of trying to control medicine. Yeah, I can remember public health, way back then,
Are there any areas of medicine that outside of a practice that you're particularly interested in, like, say, certain ethical issues or certain political issues that deal with medicine? And if so, you know, if you just want to talk a little bit about that and maybe, again, you know, give a little perspective of what that was kind of like when you were starting and, you know, maybe what it's kind of evolved into.
Well, probably I'm not halfway guilty. I am certified in quality assurance and utilization review.
Oh, okay.
I am supported by the American Board of Quality Assurance and Utilization.
Oh.
And so this is way back in the 80s, 70s, actually, I started doing utilization review. And working with such agencies as Mass Patrol and going to various hospitals in Health Row. I've been to about every hospital in the state of Massachusetts.
Oh,
wow.
When did that concept begin to originate?
Title 18, 19, what is it? public law, 1867. That's when the Medicare developed, and to control it after the first 2 years, I guess they decided that they would need a review, see what is going on, and therefore we started UR, utilization review, and from there decided that there would have to be some kind of control, so they set up a quality program, maintenance program, and so it all issued from there, in which we take 100 cases and see what we were doing with 100 cases, and can we take these 100 cases, and it all got joined in with the Joint Commission on Hospital Accreditation, and it became a big thing. So to boil down to the point where we are now of quality, management. So everybody has to, all hospitals had a utilization review committee, and then I guess it was in the 80s that the utilization review committee became the utilization review and quality assurance committees, and their job was to make sure that for quality assurance you needed just more than the hospital staff, you needed the staff, you needed the administrators and trustees all together to make these decisions, because you had to make big changes. Mm-hmm. And these changes had to be accepted by the board. If the board accepts them, then they become rules.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a big issue, trying to get management and the board involved in these decision making on a hospital wide basis.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been interesting. Doing that work, I did cause some confusion, some chaos on the university.
What happened there?
I guess this is when cardiac bypass surgery.
Mm-hmm.
They were admitting people, and you know, the next thing you know, without anything on them, in the report, they were up in surgery getting bypass, and then a rank to say why they were doing this. You know, they were admitting people from small hospitals. It just took time for paperwork to catch up, and so after doing this for several days, I finally said, "Well, look, we got do something about this." So I wrote a couple of nasty notes. And it did go up for their committees, and we wanted to know, who was this guy coming in and tell us what?
Yeah.
I see there now when everyone is admitted for bypass surgery, it's well documented. All facts and all. I's are dotted and T's are crossed.
Mm.
That was awful. I couldn't go anywhere. Wow. So maybe that's one of the things that's been a problem with old man. So I call myself basically a doc cop. But 99% of the time they did good medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the beginning was, people staying in the hospital too long, trying to shorten days.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've done days short, maybe got too short. Stop thinking about it. Time to sit back now and say, okay, do we really need 20, are we really justified putting someone out of maternity in 24 hours?
Right. How do you feel about that? That's a very hot topic today.
My daughter-in-law, they were 24 hour. Well, my daughter-in-law was a little bit off because she had C-section, so she stayed in, I guess, 48 hours when my daughter was put out in 24 hours. They gave her a crash course on how to feed a baby, how to take care of a baby, and all that. But,
this is tape number 2 of the interview with Dr. John Goldsberry on October
12th, 95. Okay. And I have 4 kids.
Mm-hmm.
My last 2 were, they were C-section children. But my wife was in the hospital 3 days for the first 2, because that was more or less the way things were done back then. Well, this was in D.C. back in the late 50s. early 60s. I think they came home, they had did a handle on the child, and the mother and child were sort of a little bit better bonded under those conditions than now, when the mother just barely knows the child, and she says, what am I going to do with this thing?
Yeah.
And then, you know, parents and all that come in and give bad information because it was Joan.
Yeah,
it was my daughter. You know, we don't use talcum powder anymore, huh? So it was just things like that that grandparents had to learn. I think the courses that they take, delivery courses, are very good. We went to one. However, I think probably reconsideration for duration of stay for births, especially first births, should be considered. Mm-hmm. And maybe we go back to maybe 2-3 days for the first birth, and then after that, things might be a little different. C-sections, they should stay long after all that major surgery and stuff. Think about it. You put someone 48 hours out after having abdominal laparotomy or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Say you're on your own.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, not only you're on your own, but you're on your own with this little... So maybe laparotomy should probably stay a little bit longer. But when I was reviewing, I really didn't have any problem with length of stay with obstetrics. Probably that was my hang-up. I might have had problems with length of stay with other things. But then after what? What happened after length of stay? So we got DRGs came in.
Okay.
Diagnostic related group, yeah. And which you had to review the case for primary diagnosis, but your comorbidities have to be considered. And then in those days of hospitalization, and the comorbidities were important because that could extend the length of time on paper. So hospitals could be paid for 10 days in which they kept someone in the hospital for 5 days, they would get 10 days paid. So that was very important. So one of the things that we had to review is to make sure that the comorbidities were in fact what the doctor said. Yeah, we had to review for that.
Do you feel that that's kind of got us to the position where we are now, where, you know, they've got such inflated costs because hospitals were maybe trying to squeeze more money than what should have been, or I'm not quite sure how to take that?
Okay, let's see. Why it costs money? One of the factors, there was this thing called malpractice that came into play. And when malpractice came in, and then we had to, the lawyers took control of the practice of medicine, and all of a sudden, lawyers were telling you, you gotta get x-rayed, you gotta do this. And the next thing you know, you have a whole bunch of x-rays, a whole bunch of lab tests. Did you go to court? Did you ever go to court? And they said, well, did you get a serum asparagus level? And you said, bad. And another man never had asparagus. And they said, well, you should have had one. So therefore, we're gonna, you're guilty as charged. So that is a big factor. With the rise in cost.
Defensive medicine.
You can't practice medicine. If it's a free mind, you got to say, oh, good Lord, what about this, what about that? To the point where the good old physical examination is of questionable value.
Oh, really?
Well, I mean, you pull down a guy's eyelid if you know he's not having an iris in it, the thing is white. And if you say, well, I guess he is anemic. So therefore, I will make that assumption that he's anemic because he hasn't got any blood in his eyelids. Yeah. Or if the thing is very red, well, I guess, yeah. I mean, it's something like things like the physical examination tells you a lot, and so that you can judge from there. In the case of bone fractures or soft tissue injury, feeling, palpating, ranges of motion. strength testing. All vital. The first thing you know, a therapist says, you got to get an x-ray on that. He's got a broken wall. That's that point. What are the indications for this? You know, and probably and because somebody will write it on a piece of paper, you better get it.
Right.
Some's my lawyers.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I think if malpractice were brought to the point where they had control of pain and
suffering.
In other words, if that wasn't the big bugaboo, in other words, you what is the value of this fractured arm?
Mm-hmm.
And let it go with that, I think it'll solve a lot of our problems. It'll bring down the cost of her medicine. It'll bring down the cost of medical care. I really don't believe that the physician per se is overcharging. The system is overcharging.
Meaning what?
Because you have to do all these things. And therefore, you got to order all the lab tests in the world.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other factors you think that are contributing to that besides the malpractice? Such as the rise in insurance companies or, you know, people taking away autonomy or whatnot.
Yeah, well, okay, they're taking away autonomy. What they are doing, you take two physicians of equal caliber,
mm-hmm.
equal training, all that. One does everything the insurance company wants. Another one sort of does few things that he wants to do. And in 100 cases, this guy has done exactly everything that he should do. This guy has done maybe 50% of what the insurance company says it should be done. What's going to happen a year later? He's not going to get cases.
Oh, okay.
This guy's going to get all the cases. So they have a way of saying, you can do what you want to do, Doc. No problem. But then find you don't get good cases, the referrals.
What kind of effect does that have?
I don't know, but I noticed this happens in a lot of freestanding clinics. That one clinic sort of is doesn't get the case referrals anymore. And finally, a lot of like when my wife was in youth guidance, and a lot of the youth guidance centers have closed down. Because of the fact that they probably, their figures, their costs were a little bit higher than, so the place with the lowest costs to the insurance ends up with the cases. The other one is forced to, you know, close down because they were a little bit more, academic.
Mm-hmm. And that sounds to me like it would have some sort of an effect. I mean, it must have an effect on the care of the patients, because that means that the patients have to go somewhere else.
Right.
If they're able to go somewhere else.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Do you find that type of scenario to be happening more nowadays, or where do you see that going?
I think it's going to happen more and more until, I don't know what's going on. Somebody just overworked where they can't function anymore. That's what's going to happen. And then the other guy just falls by the wayside, you know. I don't know what he does.
Right.
Unless he's, you know, complies. We have insurance companies that are setting of standards of care. The doctors aren't really setting these standards of care. The insurance company said, well, this is what you will do for that. What good are you?
That's kind of depressing.
It is. I was telling the wife, I am so glad I'm on the far end of the spectrum.
That leads me right into what I was going to ask you about. Yeah?
No, but go ahead, continue with that thought. that, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what you're going to do. I can't predict a future for them. I can tell my kids, and there are other things that matter to me. I mean, it might be happy. Everybody's wanting quality assurance.
Right.
Before the motor company got a better handle on quality assurance and medicine.
Yeah. Why do you think that is? Why do you think medicine has had that problem with quality assurance? My feeling on it was always that quality assurance in medicine was always something that was assumed because you are dealing directly with the lives of your patients, so... Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't know that to necessarily be true, you know,
yeah,
I don't
get
your opinion on that,
yeah.
But that has been my kind of thinking about it, that quality assurance in medicine has always been assumed, but now they are applying principles that have been applied in the business world
right.
to medicine, and again, that maybe that whole idea of the medicine becoming a business in many, you know, like way, manner after manner after manner.
Okay. Ford Motor Company doesn't practice making cars.
Mm-hmm.
You practice medicine. Unless they take the word practice out and you will what? Produce.
Mm-hmm.
I
right.
don't know. What is it? What is it?
I don't know.
That's what I think. I mean, we have the idea that we go out and practice.
Mm-hmm.
And practice means you try. You really don't have, you got an idea, but you don't have complete nuts and bolts.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, there's the variations. Are as numerous as the people coming in and going out.
Okay.
No two pneumonias are the same.
Mm-hmm.
All you know is pneumonia.
Right.
So, you know how to treat viral pneumonia like you treat pneumococcal pneumonia, but you're not going to treat every pneumococcal pneumonia case the same. And the so-called comorbidities added to the pneumonia fact that man might be alcoholic and he did this and this, this and all these other factors,
yeah,
gonna make changes. And so therefore, I don't think he can really tell someone, they claim it, they suggest.
Mm-hmm.
But their suggestions,
right.
Other things that you, that's it. Well, you really haven't gone along with our suggestions all the way, Doctor, so therefore you fall out of our spectrum of what we want.
Right.
So you won't get the referrals. Why is it some guys get them and other guys don't?
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question.
Yeah. They say you, in order to do, you have to be board qualified, board certified in order to, that is what? That means that you have satisfied a group of guys saying that you probably know what you're talking about in an examination, but not everybody can take an examination.
Oh, no?
No.
Why not?
I don't know. Because of variation, aren't they just like the...
Yeah, I don't know how the boards are run in that manner once you get out of medical school.
Well, you take a written exam, and then you take an oral exam, and you smell right, look right, and use the right cue words, then I guess you're born it. Answer board.
But only certain people can take the boards?
Everybody.
Okay.
But now, you got to remember that there's a change in, okay, you know, I never heard of boards until I got halfway through medical school.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I mean, that's... It wasn't every day... And nowadays, you know about boards before you even get out of high school.
Yeah.
Well, we knew we had to, you know, pass the a state board.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, that was the only boards we knew about.
Hmm.
Well, there was the board of medicine, board of that, but you got... In my year, my days, a lot of the physicians never got boards.
Oh, really?
Yeah. For the simple reason, what did it mean?
Right.
Well, we're on that end of the spectrum now. We don't have to worry about it. But
We do.
You have to. What does that mean?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, so now,
I was licensed for life when I got my license back.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, somehow, something with this quality on us decided, well, you have to take, first you have to take so many hours of education every day.
Oh, right.
Yeah, we were doing that automatically. You just wanted to keep up with it anyhow, so no one had to tell me anything. Then they started giving you, that you have to do this and you have to do that. And that, well, what is that going to do to a lot of people?
What do you mean, I got it?
I mean, that takes the joy out of doing it, right? So what happened is, I don't know, they would set up these courses and the guys would sign up, go to them, spend 5 minutes and thing and go out and play golf, just come and sign in. Yeah, all right. So that got caught up with. So that was, now you have to have 50 hours every 2 years of Category 1 education of that. You have to have 3 or 4 hours in risk management.
Okay.
You have to have a couple hours now, I guess, in HIV.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't know. That's probably coming up with this, but they're talking about everybody has to have some little education in HIV. Well, yeah, okay. Maybe it's not required. If things go the way they're going, that'll be on the docket. Then you have to, I guess they still do it. Every baby born in Massachusetts had to have penicillin in their eyes.
Oh, really?
Something like that, yeah, because,
The silver nitrate.
Silver nitrate, that's it, yeah, because what, gonorrhea or something.
Yeah, something like that,
I don't know if they still do that or not.
I think they do, actually.
Okay, but these are laws that come in, damn, they have to get wiped out of the books.
Right.
Yeah,
the marriage testing.
That's right, yeah. So, where was I? So you have to have these so many hours. You have to have this. Now if you're boarded, you have to pass your boards every 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Go back and take them again. Now what happens if you flunk them?
That's a good question. What does happen?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Never had to do that, right?
No. That was grandfather clause.
Huh? I don't know. You wouldn't not pass them. Or you take them to your pass them or something.
I guess so. I guess, pass and pendant. I have no idea. Nowadays, if you don't pass your boards within 2 tests or 3 tests, then you've got to start your residency all over again.
Oh, really?
Yeah, or do some coursework or something of natural, So, is this, in fact, making a better doctor?
What do you think?
I'm not the judge. I'm just not on the fire.
Right. Do you deal a lot with students or residents?
I know you said
you don't really like the academic part of it.
I had a medical school when I was into the first class. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess it was such a bad experience. I've never had to care.
Oh, no, what happened?
We had a good time. At that time I was, worked at Rutland, I worked at, City. I worked at, Place Central Mass Rehab, so I was all over. And then I was going to, a few of the, hospitals doing electromyography and all this. I was young and ambitious and full of energy. And so he would go with me to all of these places.
Oh.
I really don't know how much medicine I taught. We learned a lot of anatomy as far as limb anatomy is concerned, and muscle and nerves and blood vessels, innervation and all that.
in hand. Just refresh your course before
you
party. So that was one experience, but then I had one other medical student that was totally uninterested in physical medicine, and he just lasted about 2 or 3 days and then drifted away. I don't know what I could do to give enthusiasm. Of course, I had a lot of students who were physical therapists, occupational therapists, like Lou.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like forever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I don't think physical medicine was really their bag.
I see.
In those years. But I see where a lot of people are going into physical medicine now, and I don't know what their motivation is. It's such a, you know, such a, especially long-term care, it's forever before you get any real results with people.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, there are five now, all under 38. That amazes me. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
Does it make you happy?
Yeah, that people are looking into this field. And
what was your favorite part about it?
I like geriatric rehab. I like strokes and the older and chronic disease.
Okay.
Yeah, that was my, I like to have a patient to help, I just.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, but that luxury of chronic disease is now a non-entity.
Why so?
Well, we only have one facility in the state left for long-term care chronic disease. Other than that, it's now in the skilled nursing facilities, nursing homes, and in acute rehab. I think acute rehab, as it is today, is a, especially the geriatric division, and maybe some of the oncology division, will graduate to a skilled nurse, and it will not be a hospital procedure. I think it's rather expensive. That's just one man working in a acute rehab facility for the past 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I see it, and I think it's an expensive luxury that could be handled very easily in your level one nursing facility. That's what I think the physiatrist is doing now. They're making contacts with nursing homes to run programs.
I see.
Yeah. So there'll be plenty of work for the physiatrist. Yeah.
What has been your favorite part of medicine, the actual practicing of medicine? If you were to, you know, give someone advice on, you know, who wants to go into the medical field, you know, what would you tell them was the best thing about it for you? Maybe not for them, but, you know, for you that you like most about it.
Oh, sitting in that office in my big chair talking.
Yeah?
Yeah. Discussing, you know, various things. There is nobody on earth, I think, I don't care how smart or how ignorant he is, that can't tell me something I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, that's,
yeah, that's where
good attitude to have.
And I did not like the restraints of production line.
Sure.
If I wanted a production line, I would have ended up over there at Norton's or someplace like that.
Mm-hmm.
I have worked in the factories.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I know what piecemeal is and all that.
Yeah.
And that has not been my bag.
I see.
I worked as a doctor in a factory once, and they wanted me to be to remember that when you have a person in this office, he is now on day rate, he is no longer on fixed rate. And therefore, you cannot talk to him like that. But if they want to talk to chat with me, really?
Yeah.
So that was not a long-lived job.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
That's interesting, though, being a doctor in a factory. I mean, it's just funny talking about now how much medicine has become sort of the factory-type thing, and being a doctor in a factory,
right, yeah,
a little amusing there.
that's why I get
depressing.
Really,
yeah.
But,
yeah.
That's right. You're going to have probably, okay, I went to my cardiologist the other day. Good guy. I like him. I went into his office. His receptionist did the EKG. I weighed myself. She did the EKG. I stayed there on that thing for about 15 minutes. He came in. He was with me exactly 5 minutes. Wrote a prescription. And a couple of, hi, how you doing? What's happening? How's your wife? How's the kids? And all that bad thing. Gone. Wow. What do you think?
I can't be very satisfying.
Presentine is the last Valium test in 2 weeks, yes, sir.
Wow. You know, one thing I find interesting is they always seem to say, you know, that's not good for the patient, and the patient doesn't enjoy that. And I would think to turn it around, too. I mean, it seems that, I mean, how happy can a physician be? Someone, especially a physician who's been in practice for, you know, maybe at least a decade or two, who is so used to having that time with that patient, and now all of a sudden, you know, it seems like they keep chipping away at all the things that made medicine an attractive field.
Yeah.
And it just makes me wonder, you know, how are people going to keep wanting to go into it?
That's right. Because, look, you, as I said, you work for the insurance company. Mm-hmm. Your boss is some administrator that says this is what they want you to do. And if you don't do it,
right,
you know where you can go. Because there's a guy down the street that's going to do it. So how important to the system, listen, my paranoia, are you?
Doesn't seem to be very important.
Yeah, but I mean, everybody makes you feel important, but however, they can sure shoot you down.
Right,
yeah.
Makes you wonder, too, about the way they keep talking about the oversupply of physicians. Makes you wonder, if there weren't such an oversupply, would you be able to have insurance companies that can willy-nilly, you're in, you're out, you're in the plan, you're out of the plan, you know? Any final thoughts, or I don't want to keep you too much longer.
No,
so.
Okay.
As you reflect back on your career.
I'll say that it was fun in one time, but now it was a labor of love. Now it's a labor. How's that?
Sounds good to me. I like that.
I wish you luck.
Thanks. With hope.
Well, I mean, what do you want to do?
This concludes the interview with Dr. John J. Goldsberry by Christopher Garofalo, class of 1998 at UMass Medical School.